welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Friday, December 2nd. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. We're taking a look at the front page, and we have a large color picture of two students, according to the story, two students standing what looks like next to or underneath the Statue of Liberty, which is a landmark in the front of City High School. And the headline, Iowa City students walk out to protest gun violence. This is reported by Grace King of the Gazette, and it's from Iowa City. After students at Southeast Junior High and Iowa City High Schools learned five people were killed in a shooting last month in an LGBTQ nightclub in Colorado Springs, Colorado, they wanted to take action. So Gigi Godwin, 15, a freshman at City High, and Ace Drumbarger, 14, an eighth grader at Southeast Junior High, organized a protest Thursday of gun violence. More than 50 students walked out of school about 11 a.m. to head in below freezing temperatures for the two-mile round trip to the Pentecrest at the University of Iowa. Godwin read the names of each victim of the November 19 shooting at Club Q in Colorado Springs, a safe haven for people who are LGBTQ, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer. Drumbarger, a transgender male, said it's really scary to know people were targeted in a place they thought they were safe. At any time, anywhere I go, I could be one of the one who doesn't get to tell my mom goodbye, he said. There have been 35 school shootings across the nation and that resulted in injuries or deaths so far in 2022. Eighth grader Ace Drumbarger and ninth grader Gigi Godwin, this is the caption for the picture, provide safety instructions Thursday to students before marching to the Pentecrest in Iowa City to protest gun violence. The photo is taken by Savannah Blake of the Gazette. I'm continuing with the article. So far, we talked about the 35 school shootings across the nation resulting in injuries or deaths so far in 2022. That is, so far, according to the Education Week. Throughout the United States this year, there have been 611 mass shootings, making 2022 the second worst year for gun violence in almost a decade. Drumbarger recited the number of deaths in school shootings over the last several years, including Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas in May, Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida in 2018, and Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut in 2022. Drumbarger said he flinches when he hears a door slam too hard or a balloon pop in school. Nearly every student has anxiety about a possible shooting at school, he said. No family should be missing a child at Christmas this year or have an extra chair at family meals, Drumbarger said. I pray for all out there dealing with the aftermath of gun violence. In an email to families earlier this week, City High Principal John Bacon said students have a right to protest and the district honors their right to free speech. When a collective group, like our student body, takes interest in topics to help make a difference, we support them and want to work with them to do so in a positive and meaningful manner, Bacon said in an email. School is a great place for our students to learn about proper civil discourse, and our educators are poised to be mentors on these topics. Julia Fitzpatrick, 12, a seventh grader at Southeast Junior High, said gun violence is a really big problem. Missing a couple hours of school is way less important than fighting for the right to live, she said, while holding a sign that reads, "Strange, but people without guns rarely shoot anyone." Peter Brozini, 15, a freshman at City High, said he wants the students' voices to be heard and is worried about the impact of guns. We need to shape the world we want to live in, he said. Scarlett Carino Merrick, 12, seventh grader at Southeast, said it felt weird to quote, just leave school to the middle of the day, but it feels like we're doing the right thing, unquote. The Iowa City School Board Tuesday heard a presentation from IntelliSee, a surveillance company based in Coralville that uses artificial intelligence to continuously scan existing surveillance cameras for potential threats. With the growing threat of gun violence, IntelliSee can create safer schools without adding more equipment, according to the presentation. For example, the technology could stop a potential catastrophe by detecting drawn weapons before they're being used. It also could detect slip hazards before someone falls and help school officials react faster if they do. The school board is expected to approve an agreement for a pilot program with IntelliSee piloting later this month. President Joe Biden last week said he wants to sign into law a ban on high-powered or semi-automatic guns like an AR-15 that have the capacity to kill many people very quickly. But in a closely divided Congress, such a law is unlikely anytime soon. The Democratic-led House passed legislation in July to revive a 1990s-era ban on assault weapons with the president's support. The article includes two more color pictures of the students gathered in front of the Pentecrest holding their rally. At the bottom of the front page, we have a story reported by Trish Mahaffey of the Gazette from Anamosa. Parents of nurse killed at prison site, negligence. The parents of a nurse murdered by two Anamosa prison inmates last year is suing the Iowa Department of Corrections, Iowa Prison Industries, and Anamosa State Penitentiary, and the former warden, saying their negligence led to her death. Lorena Schulte was working as a registered nurse at the prison on March 23, 2021, when inmates Thomas Woodward and Michael Dutcher attacked her and a correctional officer, Robert McFarland, with hammers they had checked out as part of a work program. Their daughter suffered severe injury leading up to her death as a result from the attack and died from those injuries. According to a wrongful death suit filed by her parents, Stephanie and George Schulte in Jones County District Court. Lorena Schulte died from blunt force head injuries. She had a laceration to her right upper eyelid with underlying skull fractures, bleeding in her brain, and blunt force injuries to her chest, left shoulder, and right leg, according to the autopsy report attached to the lawsuit. Lorena Schulte, 50, of Cedar Rapids, and McFarland, 46, of Ely, were bludgeoned to death in the inmates' failed escape attempt. The two inmates, being supervised by McFarland, had checked out the hammers and a metal grinder from the prison maintenance area. They were planning to cut through bars with the metal grinder, but the bars held. A prison dental assistant, Lori Mathis, and another inmate, McKinley Roby, were also injured during the attack. Woodward, 43, and Dutcher, 28, pleaded to two counts of first-degree murder, one count each of attempted murder and second-degree kidnapping. They were each sentenced to life in prison without parole. The lawsuit contends Jeremy Larson, who was the Anamosa prison warden at the time, was, quote, grossly negligent, unquote, in several areas, including providing a safe working environment, sufficient staffing and training, and safety protocols. He also failed to appropriately screen inmates for eligibility in the prison industry program and to respond to employee complaints regarding safety, the suit states. Larson's negligence in the operation and supervision of the staff and inmates at the prison caused the damages suffered by Schulte's parents, according to the lawsuit. After the attack, Larson was reassigned to another corrections department role, and the Iowa legislature approved $20 million in additional money for the corrections department, with a large share to be used to fill vacancies. Prompted by the attack, the department hired a consultant to launch a seven-month security review of Iowa's prison system. While the majority of the report was never released to the public, a summary showed crowding and challenges in recruiting and retaining staff create potential security risks in Iowa's 9 prisons. The consultant also said the corrections department needs to develop a better screening process to match offenders' behavior, history, and characteristics to their work assignments, finding different prisons had different protocols for the inmates to access tools and chemicals. The wrongful death lawsuit touches on some of those same issues. It contends the defendants placed Lorena Schulte in a position of danger that she wouldn't have otherwise faced, allowing Woodward and Dutcher access to a hammer and other tools as part of the inmate work program. The risk was, quote, compounded, unquote, by the defendant's lack of supervision over the inmates, the suit asserts. The defendants also caused damages, including pain inflicted leading up to Lorena Schulte's death and suffering and loss of consortium to the Schultes by their intentional conduct resulting in the wrongful death of their daughter, according to the suit. The defendants' actions were done with malice or reckless disregard for Lorena Schulte's rights, meriting an award of punitive damages. The defendants also violated Lorena Schulte's due process rights by inadvertently supervising inmates in the work program, failing to implement appropriate safety measures and training, insufficiently staffing the prison, and providing inmates with access to dangerous weapons in an unreasonable, unnecessary, or reckless manner, resulting in her death, the lawsuit states. The article includes a picture of Lorena Schulte, the murdered victim, and there's another picture I'll read the caption, memorials placed near the front of the Anamosa State Penitentiary in Manamosa, March 24, 2021. Inmates used hammers to attack prison staff members, killing a nurse and correctional officer, authorities said. The picture is taken by Jim Sosiarik of the Gazette. And staying on the front page, we have a right side panel column. Headline, Cedar Rapids must reapply for grant for Cedar Lake. This is reported by Marissa Payne. A state panel on Thursday asked the city of Cedar Rapids to reapply for grant funding to support the Gazette-led Connect CR project to revitalize Cedar Lake and terminated its existing $500,000 award. But city officials say the decision won't stop the transformative endeavor from moving forward. The city had requested the Enhance Iowa Board amend its contract supporting phase one of the project to reimagine the lake just north of downtown and construct a pedestrian-like bike bridge spanning the Cedar River to the south. In 2020, the board awarded a $500,000 community attraction and tourism grant to help the $12.5 million Cedar Lake revitalization portion of the overall $20 million project. The project is underway and keeping to its planned timeline of completion in 2025. But the city was looking to amend its agreement with the board to support a narrower scope, aspects of the project that could be finished by December 31, 2023, deadline stipulated in the contract, in the award. Assistant Community Development Director Adam Lindenlaub told the board those elements included $2.7 million improvements to approximately 1,200 feet of the shoreline of Cedar Lake by extending the bank to make room for a new trail. The $900,000 paved trail will be about 2,650 feet long and 12 feet wide, creating a continuous trail loop that doesn't interact with vehicular traffic. So far, Lindenlaub said engineering and design work has been underway to take the elements created by the citizens and bring them into reality. Cedar Rapids contracted with Canadian firm WSP USA for over $1.2 million to provide technical designs and engineering for new amenities at Cedar Lake, the pedestrian bridge, and the connecting trails. In terms of construction, Lindenlaub said the city has made some improvements to the Causeway Bridge for the trail. As of June, he said, the city has expended almost $1.1 million on Cedar Lake. Lindenlaub said the city is working with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources on Cedar Lake improvements and with the Army Corps of Engineers on flood control work around the lake with the construction of a levee on the west side. Based on discussions with those agencies, the first phase of the project is now set to be bid in spring 2023, so the city needed to extend its timeline to factor in how to structure improvements such as potential dredging of the lake. The board decided it would be best for Cedar Rapids to reapply with a refined project scope rather than amend the existing agreement. Board members indicated Cedar Rapids might be better positioned by reapplying, as there will be more money to give to communities who apply by the January 15th, 2023 deadline than there was in 2020. I don't think there is any question this is an invaluable, necessary project for Cedar Rapids that we should have money in, said board member Kyle Carter. We are just in this weird bind as it stands on how to go about the process of doing that. Some board members took issue with the proposed scope of the project Cedar Rapids asked the board to support. They indicated support for the whole project, but were less enticed by the request to help fund this narrow component of it. Cedar Lake's transformation will add a boardwalk extending over the 120-acre lake and handicap-accessible piers. Project plans also involve preserving wetlands on the north shore, installing a fishing jetty, adding a paddle sport launch locations, floating islands, and a nature-based playground. I don't think it would score well if we had to reevaluate it, board member Lisa Hines said, of the narrower project. To me, it's the whole package. The community development director, Jennifer Pratt, said those elements won't be ready until after 2023, which is why the city sought to support specifically for the shoreline and trail improvements. With other funds locked in from Linn County, the Hall Perrine Foundation, and other private donors that do not go toward specific elements of the project, Pratt said there are no concerns about the project's ability to move forward. The amendment requested was intended to use the CAT funds efficiently. Several board members were sympathetic to the delays involved when collaborating with other government agencies. Perhaps this application came in a little early in retrospect, board member Pat Danian said, but some things are beyond their control. City Council member Dale Todd, who has long championed the effort, said Connect CR is a complicated project with many moving parts. Having to reapply will fit the city's timeline better, he said, as the grant would then cover the completion of the project. It fits perfectly with our vision and our timeline, Todd said. The article is accompanied by a beautiful colored artist rendering of what the completed project would look like, an aerial view, and we have an actual picture of Cedar Lake as it appears with Interstate 380 in the upper part skirting the lake. And now it's time to turn to the insight page for the Gazette's editorial. Need is growing in Iowa. Gazette reporters in recent days have painted a grim picture of the economic struggles being faced in Cedar Rapids and Linn County and the organizations scrambling to help. The Gazette's Elijah Decius reported that the number of people living outdoors has quadrupled since 2017 and has tripled since July 2019 to more than 100, according to annual counts of homeless people. The number of people who are at risk of losing housing being served by Waypoint's Housing Services Program has increased from 3,000 in fiscal 2019 to 13,000 clients this year. The Gazette's Emily Anderson reported that local food pantries are finding it more difficult to meet the rising demand for food help since extra pandemic related federal nutrition benefits ended in Iowa. HACCP, which distributes food to many area pantries, is facing a decline in food available from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, along with a decrease in donations and an increase in food prices. The Gazette's Gage Meskimen reported that agencies helping Iowans receive utility assistance are bracing for high demand as American households face the highest heating costs in 25 years. A tight winter fuel market has been exacerbated by the war in Ukraine. In a recent editorial, we called for people to volunteer their time and donate dollars to organizations dealing with myriad needs for housing, food assistance, and other necessities. But this is not an isolated situation facing only Cedar Rapids or Iowa's metro areas. These are problems affecting rural and urban Iowans alike. For example, according to statistics compiled by the state on how many students are eligible for free reduced-price food lunches, shows many rural schools are with eligibility counts above 50%. At Schuller Elementary School in Atlantic, 59% of students are eligible. Lakeview Elementary in Centerville is at 58%. West Sioux Middle School in Haywarden is at more than 59%. Certainly, coordinated local efforts are needed to address these issues, but this is also a statewide problem. Republicans spent much of the recent midterm campaign criticizing inflation and other economic woes they blamed on President Joe Biden. But now, as the Reynolds administration crafts its budget priorities and GOP lawmakers prepare to take over even larger legislative majorities, they have a chance to do something for struggling Iowans, most of whom are working. Maybe instead of another round of tax cuts benefiting the wealthy, the state could make new investments in affordable housing, child care, food assistance, and other priorities. Perhaps the minimum wage could be raised after 15 years. The legislature could tackle the hundreds of billions of dollars pocketed by unscrupulous businesses through wage theft. The list is long. That would let Iowans know that all the campaign talk about hardworking Iowans facing economic difficulties wasn't just talk. It should be a call to action, and state leaders must heed it. That's the Gazette's editorial in today's issues. There is one community letter submitted by Marjorie Arp of Marion, and the title of the letter is "Fortunate to Have Pain Relief Options Locally." We have excellent health care in Cedar Rapids metro area. For many of us, travel time is within 15 to 30 minutes from our home to the chosen health care provider. Anyone who has endured persistent neck, back, knee, hip, shoulder, sciatica, or nerve entrapment pain and other painful conditions knows that it's possible to come to the end of the road in finding treatment. I found myself in that position, and you have the sinking feeling that you have exhausted all treatment options. You begin to wonder if there is any help available to you after being treated by several healthcare providers. One healthcare provider you might not know about is Thrive Care in Cedar Rapids. I found help at Thrive Care, which is owned by Dr. Cody and Amber Scharf. Dr. Cody Scharf, Dr. Logan Scharf, and supporting staff offer shockwave therapy for advanced non-surgical soft tissue treatment for relief from chronic inflammation and pain. After a consultation, examination, and treatment for the first time in 3 years after having a kyphoplasty surgery for a fractured vertebra, I could say I was pain-free from nerve entrapment, scar tissue, and fibrous adhesions. The physical and psychological effect is immense. That's the letter submitted by Marjorie Arp of Marion. And staying on the Insight page, we have a guest editorial from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. End reign of Iowa, New Hampshire. Thank you for your service, Iowa and New Hampshire, but it's time to end the prominent, influential perch you two small rural states have long enjoyed in winnowing the list of presidential contenders. Another state or states should get a chance to sort through candidates and make an early choice in the nation's first caucus or primary. Officials for both political parties should acknowledge a switch is overdue and then swiftly offer alternatives soon. That would give the new state or group of states enough time to plan for this earlier responsibility. An influential Democratic Party committee is considering the issue this week. Iowa Democrats' dismal handling of the 2020 caucuses, where technological glitches delayed results, provided additional motivation to tap another location. Without a change, the 2024 presidential election will soon put the two states at the center of the American political universe once again. The Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary have enjoyed a first-in-the-nation honors for decades. With those very early dates comes a massive media spotlight, extra political clout for the state's voters, and an unparalleled opportunity to see candidates close up. Winter winds may now sweep through the Iowa State Fairgrounds, but it's mere months before political coverage features shop-worn photos of presidential hopefuls grilling pork chops or glad-handing livestock exhibitors. Enough already. This is a tradition that has grown stale, nor does it serve the nation well. As a Brookings Institution white paper notes, the demographics in Iowa and New Hampshire are at odds with the nation's more diverse and urbanized population. Quote, with a white population share of 85% to 90% respectively, compared to 60.4% for the nation as a whole, they are the sixth and fourth whitest states. They also have somewhat older age structures, decidedly less urbanized populations, and a much higher representation of white adults without college educations than the rest of the nation, unquote, the report states. Other states' voters, along with the issues important to them, deserve to share the spotlight that Iowa and New Hampshire have enjoyed. That front row seat might also galvanize voters in the new state or states to get involved. There would be some trade-offs, as there are with most changes. For example, the small geographic footprints of Iowa and New Hampshire, along with their relatively inexpensive media markets, can allow a dark horse candidate lacking resources to compete early on. But that alone isn't a strong enough argument to stay the course. There are other states that could offer up similar conditions. Another consideration is, if a decision is made soon to allow another state to go first or early, is there enough time for its election officials to organize and set up for the earlier contest? In a recent interview with an editorial writer, Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon said states generally are nimble enough to quickly adjust their calendars. He added that Minnesota could handle such a switch. Iowa and New Hampshire have had a good run. It's time for a change. And that was the guest editorial from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on this Friday, December 2nd. This is on IRIS, Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now, let's turn to today's obituaries. First, we have two shorter notices. From Tama, Cecil Bud Bearden, 92, died on Wednesday, November 30, the Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. From Tipton, Patricia Pat Fankhauser, 93, died Wednesday, November 30, the Fry Funeral Home, Tipton. Now among our regular notices, Donna Jean Albin, Central City, died on Tuesday, November 29, services 11 a.m. Friday, December 2nd, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Central City, interment in Mount Clark Cemetery, Iowa, Central City. Memorials in Donna's memory may be directed to the American Heart Association, and the Murdoch Funeral Home is a place, their website is a place to share a memory of Donna under obituaries. From Van Horn, Karen Blanchard Court, C-O-H-R-T. Karen Blanchard Court, 77, died November 28th in Grinnell, Iowa. Visitation, 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday, December 4, at Phillips Funeral Home in Keystone. Interment will be held at a later date. And condolences can be mailed on behalf of Karen Blanchard Court's family, and for Karen, at can be mailed to 1519 3rd Avenue, Grinnell, 50112. Online condolences, phillipsfuneralhomes.com. From Prairieburg, Tom Walker, 90, died unexpectedly on Tuesday, November 29, at his home. Mass of Christian burial, 11 a.m. Monday, December 5th, St. Joseph Catholic Church, Prairieburg. Interment, St. Joseph Cemetery. Military honors will be accorded by the U.S. Army and the Central City Legion Post, Wapsie Post 421. Visitation, 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, December 4, at Getz Funeral Home, Monticello, with a parish vigil service, 4 p.m. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Walker family in memory of Tom Walker. From Washington, Iowa, Marjorie C. Klein, that's K-L-I-N-E, 76, died Sunday, November 27, at Halcyon House following a lengthy illness from complications with Alzheimer's. The family will be present to receive friends from 1 to 2 p.m. Saturday, December 3rd, at the Jones and Eden Funeral Home. Memorials have been established for the Iowa Barn Foundation, the Alzheimer's Association, or Hospice of Washington County. The Jones and Eden Funeral Home is assisting the family of Marjorie C. Klein, and condolences may be sent to Marjorie's family through the website jonesfh.com. From Marion, June Catherine Sanders, 80, passed away November 29 at Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. Celebration of Life, 4 to 6 p.m. December 9 at Brosh Chapel, 2121 Bowling Street, Southwest Cedar Rapids. Online condolences are welcome at iowacremation.com under obituaries for June Catherine Sanders of Marion. From Williamsburg, Newell Arp passed away peacefully on Tuesday, November 29, at Highland Ridge Care Center in Williamsburg at the age of 87. Celebration of Life service will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday, December 3rd, at the St. Paul Lutheran Church in Williamsburg. Their burial will be at the Pilot Glove Cemetery. Visitation will be held Saturday before the service from 9 to 10:15 a.m. at the church. In lieu of flowers, a memorial fund has been established for St. Paul Lutheran Church on behalf of Newell Arp. The family is appreciative of the care Newell received by the staff at Highland Ridge Care Center. Messages and tributes may be directed to powellfuneralhomes.com for Newell Arp of Williamsburg. And that concludes the listing of obituaries in today's issue. And now we turn to the sports page for a girls' basketball notebook story by Jeff Linder. Cascades opener features stirring comeback. This is reported by Jeff Linder. It didn't take long in this girls' basketball season for the Cascade Cougars to reach a moment of truth, about 16 minutes. At halftime, Tuesday at West Liberty, I figured the game could go one or two ways, Cougars coach Mike Esconza said. I was hoping we could fight back, take a respectable loss. I was scared that we would lose by 35 and think on the ride home, oh boy, it's going to be a long season. The Cougars took a different option altogether. Trailing by 18 points at halftime, Class 2A 7th-ranked Cascade came all the way back and stunned 3A number 6 West Liberty 60-56. We had some girls that made shots in the second half, Sconza said. We did a good job distributing the ball. Before you knew it, we were able to climb out of it. Down 38-20 at the break, Cascade cut the deficit to 47-36 by the end of the third quarter, then closing with a 24-9 spree in the fourth. Alyssa Lux scored 22 points for the Cougars, now 1-0, and Molly Rowling added 13. They didn't do it alone. Claudia Noonan hit a couple of big three-pointers, Sconza said. Devin Simon is a tremendous athlete, and we put her on West Liberty's Kelsey Jones as much as we could. An Iowa State University signee and a transfer from Iowa City High, Jones was held to 19 points Tuesday after scoring 33 in her West Liberty debut on Saturday. Josie Matternack scored just 4 points for the Cougars, but grabbed 14 rebounds, including 7 on the offensive end. Mount Vernon front-loaded its schedule with 3 consecutive games against Mississippi Valley Conference schools. Then the Mustangs went out and won all 3. They came from behind to beat Western Dubuque 45-38 in their opener. They stormed away in the final 12 minutes in a 56-30 rivalry Saturday rout of Cedar Rapids Kennedy. Then they blitzed Dubuque Hempstead early in a 65-32 road romp. Volleyball star Chloe Meester leads a balanced crew at 10.3 points per game. Lily C. and Aaron Jackson are scoring 9.7 points apiece, with C leading the team in rebounds at 8 per game and Jackson hitting 8 of 12 from 3-point range. The Mustangs open WAMAC Conference play tonight with an interdivisional tussle at home with Center Point Urbana. Auburnett, 1-1, 0-1, is at Edgewood Colesburg, 1-1, 0-1, in a Tri-Rivers Conference West Division encounter tonight, and 2 of the state's top rebounders will be on display. Auburnett junior Allie Olmstead averaged 17.5 rebounds in the Pirates' first 2 games, and Edgewood Colesburg junior Audrey Helmricks netted 16 boards per game in a pair of games. The article is accompanied by a picture of 2 of the young women in action. The caption says, Cascades' Alyssa Lux drives against Central Lyon at the state tournament last year. Lux scored 22 points in the Cougars' comeback win over West Liberty on Tuesday. That photo was taken by Nick Rollman of the Gazette. Now we look at the Iowa Today page for a story by Emily Anderson. Cedar Valley Habitat for Humanity receives $1.5 million to build 6 houses. The Cedar Valley Habitat for Humanity, the nonprofit's Cedar Rapids-based affiliate, was awarded $1,549,208 on Thursday by Governor Kim Reynolds as part of the Iowa Home Grant Program. The money will be used to build 6 houses that will be offered as part of the organization's Home Ownership Program, which helps low and middle income families in Linn and Benton counties become homeowners. The requirements for the program state that a family must earn more than 30% and less than 60% of the median income in their county based on family size. In Linn County, the income for a family of 4 must be between $27,750 and $53,640. In Benton County, the range is $27,750 to $54,000. Applicants for the program also must have a demonstrated need for housing, determined based on a variety of factors, including the condition of current housing, space consideration, and cost burden. They must also have a stable, verified income that they've had for at least 1 year to support monthly mortgage payments. The nonprofit worked with the larger Habitat for Humanity of Iowa to apply for the grant a few months ago, along with several other Habitat for Humanity affiliates in the state. In total, nearly $20 million was awarded Thursday to 16 different organizations, 12 of which are Habitat for Humanity affiliates, according to a news release from Reynolds' office. The amounts awarded to individual organizations range from $241,294 for the city of DeWitt to $1,809,000 to the Muscatine Center for Social Action. The grant, quote, was created as part of Governor Reynolds' $100 million investment to increase the supply of housing options and protect and expand housing opportunities for Iowans to live in or near the communities where they work, unquote, the news release states. The investment was funded using money from the Federal American Rescue Plan Act and state and local fiscal relief funds. Cedar Valley Habitat for Humanity does not have specific plans outlined for the 6 new houses it will build, but now that funding is secured, the search for available property will begin. Brittany Scanlon, executive director of Cedar Valley Habitat for Humanity, said $1.5 million should cover the entirety of the cost of the houses. Quote, it's a lot of funding, and 6 houses is quite a few houses to be building, so we wanted to wait to get the word if we received the grant funding first before we would go ahead and secure any lots of materials or anything of that nature, Scanlon said. One of the requirements of the grant is that the funding has to be used before 2026, Scanlon said. The nonprofit has already worked out a tentative construction schedule for the next few years to make sure the houses can be completed in time without conflicting with other projects that are already planned. We return to the Insight page for a syndicated columnist, Froma Harup. Apple is real, Twitter not so much. What do I care about more? Do I care about my iPhone, my iPad, my MacBook, and the 2 Mac desktops, or do I care more about the feed on my Twitter app? Oh, and I forgot to mention my Apple Watch. Guess the answer. I used to greatly admire Twitter owner Elon Musk for his championing of electric vehicles. That Tesla made him the world's richest man was fine with me. But Musk can't possibly think that he can win his fight against Apple, the world's most valuable company. That's assuming his motive is to indeed win and not just gorilla glue his name to the daily headlines. In the name of free speech, Musk is opening Twitter to unmoderated bigots, vaccine deniers, and other assorted creeps. That's his right. Apple wants to keep the worst nastiness out of its users' faces. It has thus banned from its App Store sites that do not meet its standards for moderating content, That is Apple's right. And it's the right of Apple and other big corporations to not advertise on the burning dumpster Twitter is becoming. At the end of the day, what is Musk's weapon, really? A social media app? This is a battle for the future of civilization, Musk tweeted. If free speech is lost, even in America, tyranny is all that lies ahead. To which former Representative Adam Kinzinger tweeted, it's Twitter, man, not World War III. Musk overpaid $44 billion to buy Twitter. Apple, on the other hand, is worth $2.3 trillion. Investors, meanwhile, have limited patience with CEOs who get distracted from their core business and come off as jerks. Who is taking care of Tesla? This has been a tough year for many stocks, but for Teslas, it's been miserable. As of late November, Tesla shares have lost nearly 50% of their value. The 2022 return on Apple shares, which includes dividends, was down only 18.31%. Apple world tends to be a gentle place. Its inhabitants undoubtedly like the company's moves to protect user privacy. Apple also wins applause for banning misinformation about COVID-19, something Twitter has just said it would now allow. By the way, it's simply not true that only liberal social media gets the Apple green light. Anyone who has used Apple products to follow political opinion knows that conservative views are easy to find. It would appear that all the money in the world couldn't buy Musk a sense of humor, and that's what he's going to need if the day comes that Apple drops Twitter from the App Store and the 1 billion iPhone owners start forgetting that Twitter ever existed. That's the guest column submitted by Froma Harup, a syndicated columnist distributed by Creators. And now we turn to the Living page for a column headline, and the author is Brian Bush. State of Mind is the column. His title, Are Your Holiday Traditions Healthy? Whether it's a Thanksgiving feast, waking up early to shop for the best bargains, attending church on Christmas Eve, lighting the menorah, or toasting at midnight on New Year's Eve, these weeks are filled with people celebrating holidays and moments with their own traditions. Ask 100 people about their holiday traditions, and you're bound to get 100 different responses. Many people certainly enjoy and value their traditions, while others dread and even resent them. Regardless of where you stand, for better or worse, traditions play a significant role in our mental health. Traditions can be driven by culturally specific customs, beliefs handed down by generation, or simply regular patterns of actions. Some of these things, such as the way in which we commonly name children, might never be consciously considered or even recognized. Others, such as the ways a family celebrates birthdays, are more consciously considered. But naming conventions and birthday celebrations often look very different when it comes to the traditions of various cultures. It's important to acknowledge that cultures exist within nearly every type of group. A family has its own culture, as does a school, workplace, religion, or region of the country. While cultures include tangible things like language, symbols, clothing, or food, the bulk of what makes up any culture is intangible, such as values, beliefs, and attitudes. And those intangibles influence and shape the traditions practice within that culture. This is why a family's tradition of wearing matching pajamas and watching the same movie on a specific date each year can be held in such high regard by those who practice it. The question becomes how these things impact our mental health. Research has shown that different types of structure and routine can have a beneficial impact on mental health as people know what to expect and may feel more productive, more fulfilled, and less anxious. But adhering too strictly to routines may be detrimental if it begins to cause unnecessary pressure, burden, and worry. Along these lines, research has shown that novelty can enhance moods and lower anxiety and depression. And in that contradiction lies the challenge with tradition specifically. On one hand, traditions can offer a sense of familiarity that leads to comfort and contentment. Traditions with our families might provide the stability and predictability we need to make it through the holidays with our mental health safely intact. On the other hand, simply doing things the way they've always been done for the sake of tradition can prove unnecessarily rigid and cause anxiety to spike, particularly around the holidays when many are facing the heightened demands and expectations of families and other groups. The challenge is balancing the most important elements of your traditions with the inevitability of change. That might mean that the core of your holiday tradition is to share a meal with your extended family. Whether that occurs on a Thursday or another day, or at a certain house, or even with specific foods, might not be the most important factors. In the end, it's important to honor the heart of your traditions while remaining flexible and open to the fact that those traditions might occur on different dates, in different places, and with different elements that change over time, particularly as people and families grow and evolve. Amid that delicate balance, hopefully we can all find the patience and compassion for ourselves and each other as we share in traditions, both new and old, with families and loved ones throughout the holiday season. That column was written by Brian Bush, a licensed mental health counselor in Cedar Rapids. He also works at Folliance, the parent company of the Gazette, and he can be reached at brian.bush@thegazette.com. And still on the living page, we have another story called Life Skills. This is reported by Tom Avril of the Philadelphia Inquirer. It doesn't take a health professional to save the life of someone bleeding heavily from a gunshot wound or other traumatic injury. Any bystander can undertake a series of crucial first steps until an expert reaches the scene. These can include using a low-tech tool that's been around since the early days of medicine, a tourniquet. Experts recommend an in-person training session before using one of the straw-like devices, which must be wound so tightly around an arm or leg that it cuts off the flow of blood. But for those who have not had a hands-on lesson, the American College of Surgeons offers an online version of its Stop the Bleed curriculum at stopthebleed.org. Here are the highlights with an assist from Thomas Jefferson University Hospital nurse Nora Kramer, who has trained hundreds of adults and teens in the Philadelphia area. Make sure you are not at risk from whatever injured the person you are trying to help, whether it's gunfire, vehicle, traffic, or some other source, or blood loss. Upon determining that it is safe to begin first aid, wear a pair of gloves, if available, to reduce the risk of contracting any blood-borne disease. Above all, call 911. If two rescuers are on the scene, one can call for help while the other works to stop the bleeding. Some wounds do not require immediate treatment. To tell when bleeding is severe enough to threaten the person's life, look for these three signs: continuous bleeding, a large volume of blood, and pooling. Note that these types of severe wounds may be hidden underneath clothing. Press directly on the wound with gauze or a cloth. If that stops the bleeding, keep doing it until emergency medical professionals arrive. If bleeding continues from deep within the wound, pack it with gauze, then apply pressure again. If that fails, apply a tourniquet. A tourniquet is an option when the wound is in the arm or leg, not the neck or torso. The device consists of a strap and a stick-like attachment called a windlass. Strap the tourniquet on the limb 2 to 3 inches above the wound, but not over the elbow or knee. Twist the windlass to tighten the tourniquet until bleeding stops and fasten it into place, says Jefferson's Kramer. If applied correctly, it will hurt. Don't worry about making it too tight, said Lewis Kaplan, a professor of surgery at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine. This is a situation of life over limb. Never remove a tourniquet. Leave that to the experts. If bleeding continues, apply a second tourniquet. Many first aid kits contain a commercial tourniquet. When one is not available, rescuers can improvise a field tourniquet from a piece of cloth and a rigid object such as a pin or stick, and to serve as the windlass. But beware, says Eleanor Kaufman, a trauma surgeon at Penn Presbyterian Medical Center, if a makeshift tourniquet is not tight enough, it can accelerate the bleeding instead of cutting it off, partly on its what's worse than not at all. A commercial tourniquet has a locking mechanism to secure the windlass in place. With a field tourniquet, the windlass must be tied. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for this Friday, December 2nd. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.